Hi again, it's Doug here speaking to you from the middle of our summer break. So we've been playing some of our staff favorites during the hiatus, and this week I'm up with this show from 2011. It's a conversation we had about an entry in the Sundance Film Festival that year. And part of our coverage, and also just because of our own personal interest, we always try and profile a film that is strange or really original. And that year, we found the perfect specimen. The filmmaker Matthew Bate had gotten into the festival with this documentary he made about these two guys who moved into the apartment next door to these older guys in San Francisco. And the older guys, named Peter and Raymond, they argued constantly. They got drunk and were just awful to each other. And these arguments were horrible, but also really funny. And so the younger guys, Eddie and Mitchell, they recorded the arguments, and the cassettes they made became a cult hit. The film is called Shut Up, Little Man. So here goes our conversation from January of 2011. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival with the strange and funny and disturbing documentary called Shut Up, Little Man. It's Matthew Bates' film about Eddie and Mitch, who move into a San Francisco apartment building in the 1980s and surreptitiously record the booze-fueled fights between their neighbors, Peter and Raymond. This is not just the story behind the cassette tapes they made that became this cultural phenomenon, but the story of how the tapes took on a life of their own. Matthew Bates is joining us today to talk about the film. It's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition. Bates is based in Australia. His films include last year's Stunt Love, about silent film stunt pioneer director J.P. McGowan. We should also mention that we have sort of bleeped out the roughest language in the clips from the documentary, but it's still pretty raw and may be offensive to some and probably not suitable for younger listeners, so there's your warning. Matthew Bates, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess we should begin by asking, when did you first hear the tapes of Peter and Raymond? Did you hear them independent of this idea of a documentary at some point, or how did they come to you?
Well, maybe not independent, because I'm a documentary filmmaker. That's what I do, and my ears are like radars. Right? They're always listening for the next story. And I remember at the time I was looking for a feature documentary, a bigger idea, a bigger story. And I used to hang around a record store. I collect vinyl records. And a fellow loiterer there, who was this older guy called Ron, who was just one of those sort of mavens of kind of information, of obscure music, cultural information. And he just bailed me up one day and said, you know, you've got to listen to this recording called Shut Up, Little Man. It's about these two old guys who hate each other, and they just fight in this apartment nonstop. And I just thought that was so intriguing, just the title, Shut Up, Little Man, and this idea of these two old guys fighting and a secret recording. Wow, what is that going to sound like? Yeah. And he wrote it on a record bag that I had. He said, you know, Shut Up, Little Man. I went home and I Googled it and I listened to it, and it just blew my socks off. Yeah. You know, it was just so, it's like a car crash. You just can't help looking. And it makes you kind of complicit in, like, there's a guilty kind of pleasure to it, and it's funny and it's tragic, and it's just, and then the story behind it, yeah, is just so crazy. And the more I read about it, on, you know, Eddie has a website with the sort of history of Shut Up, Little Man. I read about it and the sort of backstory, and people like Devo were attached to it somehow, and then Nirvana was mentioned, and Daniel Klaus, the great comic illustrator of Ghost World, and suddenly you start to put these names together with the story, and you go, you've got a pitchable story and a sort of, you know, and then I became obsessed.
Really?
That's how it starts.
Yeah. Well, much of the film was about the tapes themselves. So for those unfamiliar, let's let them hear some of it. And I wondered if this is the thing that's interesting, though. Like, in some ways, you don't have to really set them up. You know, I mean, you don't have to say much about it. And in some ways, that's part of the joy for some people who did hear them, is they didn't. You don't know who they are.
That's right. I mean, you know, I think this film gives you more information than there's ever been on this. So maybe it'll spoil it for people. I don't know. I hope not. But yeah, for those people in the early days that had no idea who these guys were, and there was no website or no history to this, then it was just the great thing about Shut Up Little Man, even for me, is the mystery. There's a mystery. All these questions are thrown up. Who are these guys? How was this recorded? Like, what? What is this? Why is a gay man living with a rampant homophobe who hates him? They hate one another, yet they're obsessed by one another. I don't know. It's like, maybe it says something about every relationship, all relationships.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mystery was, you know, and for a documentary filmmaker, mystery is everything. I want to uncover the mystery, and I want it to be in my film. And yeah.
I've had enough tonight, Ray.
Well, then
shut your mouth. Then shut your mouth, you fucking piece of shit. You shut up, little man. Little man, you shut up.
I don't want to hurt you.
You've been screeching for an hour now. Stop it.
No, I haven't. You lie.
Stop it, piece of shit. You dirty little man.
You're a piece of shit.
And smelly man.
All you are is a piece of shit. I smell like a human being. You smell like a f***ing dog.
You shut up, little man.
Shut up, little man.
Shut up, little man.
What do you think about the beeps?
I was just sort of trying to hold in my laughter because it's almost funnier with the beeps because I know it so well. It's just to hear it in a different way and like how many beeps you. I'm surprised. You know, I thought it'd just be like one beep. It's great.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, this is such an obvious question, but what is it? What is it that's so intriguing about that? I mean, you were sort of talking about that before, and maybe part of it is that they're, yeah. What is it? But that it's complicated. We feel kind of guilty about listening to
Absolutely.
It.
I mean, it's like it's. I think we're voyeuristic people. Yeah. As a species, we're voyeuristic. We want to peek behind the curtains. It's why YouTube works so well, because we get to see things we wouldn't normally see. It's why paparazzi make lots of money and stalk people, and you know all that sort of thing. We want to see people's cellulite and nose jobs and all that sort of thing. And this is like the ultimate, this is like an early version of, you know, what's that thing you have here? TMZ, you know, or YouTube or whatever it is. Like these sort of things now are so popular because we get to sort of see people at their worst. And this was almost like a sort of early warning sign to all of that, I think.
Mm.
It's just the ultimate peek behind the curtains of your neighbors. Haven't you ever wondered what they're up to next door to you? You know,
absolutely.
But here you get to listen in. And not only that, it's the most bizarre relationship ever, in a way. I mean, like, if these guys, it's like the perfect storm scenario that these two young guys would move next door to these two old guys. It's this beautiful mirroring. The two old guys have got nothing to live for. The two young guys have got everything to live for.
Yeah.
And they just have this idea to record the neighbors first out of fear because they knock on the door. Obviously they go around and they knock on the door and say, can you keep the noise down? Like we're trying to sleep. We're students. And Ray answers the door.
Well, wait, let me play that clip.
All right.
Because this is Eddie talking about that. Because you know, they're hearing the screaming.
That's right.
And you do what you would do. You'd go and say, hey, look, can you maybe tone it down?
That's right. And it's like a nightmare. These guys are trying to sleep. They're trying to go to university or whatever they were doing at the time and just can't sleep because Eddie's room adjoins their lounge room.
I had had enough and I went nuts and I decided I was going to deal with it. So I went over to the next door neighbor's house and I banged on the door. Nothing's happening. And then I kicked. Boom. Finally, I could hear something kind of rattling on the other side of the door, and then the door opened up, and there was this Cro-Magnon-looking kind of guy who had the neck muscles of a newborn. I was infuriated, and I said, damn it, you know, you guys have been screaming for days. I'm trying to get some sleep. You need to shut the f*** up. So it was Ray, and he said, hey, listen, you f***er. You skinny f***er. Shut your f***ing mouth and go back to bed. I was a killer before you were born. I'll be a killer when you're dead. And I had this kind of moment where I popped into, like, sobriety. I was looking at this totally drunken who had just threatened to kill me. And I looked over, and there was a human skull in the window. And I was standing there, and I thought to myself, man, I am in way over my head here. And I kind of scurried back to my apartment.
And I remember we could hear Ray saying, come knock on my door, you dare you. I will kill.
But I'm a killer. If you want to f*** with me, you little f***ing try it. Go ahead. Come knock on my door, you little piece of shit. I will kill you instantly.
Jeez. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, so they're like, so what would you do? I mean,
so that's right. You're like 19 years old. You've moved from like the Midwest to the Big Smoke in San Francisco, and you move into this like bright pink apartment, and it's got paper thin walls, and you can't sleep because your neighbors are insane maniacs, and you knock on the door and ask them politely to, you know, keep quiet. Well, maybe not politely, but ask them to keep quiet, and he threatens to kill you, and he's killed before. Not only is he threatened to kill you, but he's killed before. Like, wow.
Well, I think the thing that is so interesting is like how you work through in the film the nature of the relationship, because it's not just these guys that hate each other. I mean, because they're together, and so the way you sort of talk about it in the film is that this was a kind of this in some ways a kind of typical domestic existence.
Yeah, I saw it in a way as a love story. In Peter and Raymond's relationship, I mean, whether it was sexual or not, I don't know. But I mean, they needed each other. It's almost like every insult was an affirmation of the other one's existence. You know, like older people. These guys were retirees. They were older men. They were living in a sort of tenement, you know, apartment. As I said before, they had nothing really to live for but each other in a way. I mean, they had no family that we know of. They needed one another. Regardless, like the hatred almost like bound them together, I think. And they died fairly close to one another, like old couples do. Yeah. You know, when the wife dies or the husband dies, quite often the other one dies, you know, relatively close to the other one. And that's what happened. I think it's a love story. Love is a weird thing, isn't it? I mean, I argue with my wife all the time. We have these like horrible fights sometimes, you know, and it's vitriolic. And I think we sound just like Pete and Ray. I think we all have these kind of sometimes have these fights with people, these relationships, and even if it's only a snippet, there's a snippet of Pete and Ray in kind of all of us in a way. I think
there's this scene from the film where Henry Rosenthal, who's a film producer and director, sort of describes Peter and Ray's relationship as this domestic prototype, is how he puts it. Let me play that part from the film. This is from Matthew Bates' "Shut Up, Little Man."
Pete and Ray functioned very much like a married couple. A lot of the arguments were about food preparation and money arguments. As a prototype of all relationships distilled down into this, you know, this eternal battle, it's unparalleled.
At what point does it occur to Eddie and Mitch to start recording them? I mean, what was the...
Right. Well, it was the death threat that we heard before. So they when Ray sort of threatens...
Evidence, right?
Right. So that's right. So they need like... they initially they do it because they're fearing for their lives and they think, we need to record evidence. What if something goes down? What if this guy comes next door with the axe or the machete or whatever he's got and does something to us? Then at least we can leave behind some evidence or, you know, whatever. So if we have to press charges, then we've got this recorded evidence. But then that becomes an obsession. So there's a transformation with Eddie and Mitch where it begins with fear, then it becomes this obsession where they're trying to gather the best material. And I think they almost try and outdo each other. You know, like Eddie goes off to uni and Mitch is back left at the apartment. He's recording this stuff. And Ed comes home. He's like, oh, man, I got this stuff today. You'll never believe what Ray said. You know, it's like, you know, and vice versa. And they start to sort of like obsess over collecting this stuff, and they become, you know, they become Pete and Ray. That's the weird thing. Like I said before, there's a mirroring, so they're doing the voices and they just talk like them, and it's this very kind of hermetic little world that they live in where they become these little obsessive Peter and Raymond fans.
And you know, the thing is, I think obsessive is right. I mean, one of the things you talk about in the film is so we go to they sort of come back to the story. They although I get the sense that for Eddie, he's been, you know, it's been sort of part of his life
Absolutely.
Since then, probably.
Yeah, yeah. It's his great art project.
Yeah, yeah. And there's this scene which we'll play where they're going through these cassettes. This obsession became this huge collection of tapes.
That's right.
You know, I've always wondered if there's stuff. I mean, in fact, not only do I know there's stuff that we recorded that I never found.
We don't have.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, when here somewhere. At the end of Ween, probably, there's like 20 minutes that we've never heard since 1985, 7 or whatever.
Could be. I know. Yeah, there's some precious stuff on here. Some of this stuff. Don't call me good night.
Don't call me good night.
Hello, you.
I'm saying good night. Don't call me good night, you.
Hello, you little queer.
If you want to talk to me, then shut your mouth.
Someday, I will kill you. That's one of my favorites.
That's one of the things I like about it, is that interchange between the two.
Yeah.
It's the way they're interacting with it.
Yeah.
It sounds weird, but there are classics in those tapes. Like, if you want, what was the part where he said, if you want to talk to me, then shut your
effing mouth. Yeah.
I mean, there are these clips that have become sort of iconic for people.
Absolutely. The great thing about them is, and they seem to come from Ray a lot, who is the sort of the rampant homophobe kind of guy. And the logic, the absurd logic of his these statements is what gets people. Because it's like, what does that mean? If you want to talk to me, then shut your mouth. What? What does that mean? It's genius. That's what I love about documentaries is, no screenwriter on earth would ever come up with that line.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And Peter has this kind of Tennessee Williams sort of bit a part about him where he sounds a bit cruel, but also there's something, a turn of a phrase that's really clever and kind of funny.
Yeah, absolutely. He's very witty in a way, and he's very camp.
Yeah.
And kind of bitchy and camp and kind of aggressive. And yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
which gives you a sort of understanding of how it is that they kind of, these tapes took on a life of their own. I mean, they became a phenomenon.
Yeah, an underground phenomenon. And the way they became a phenomenon is an amazing thing. Back in the pre-digital age, in the analog world of tape. Remember when we used to make tapes for your girlfriend?
Yeah, mixtapes.
Yeah, mixtapes. Tape, the dual tape deck thing, right? And so these guys are recording it on, they tied a microphone to a ski pole and stuck that out the window, and they're recording it that way and recording it onto their tape deck. And then, and then compiling the best bits by doing the old tape-to-tape recording. And then they leak out into the world. You know, they invite friends over for parties so they can listen to Pete and Ray next door. And they just, one guy gets a tape, one of their friends gets a mixtape. Mitch is starting to make these tapes with the Pixies on it and, whatever, Led Zeppelin. And then in between the songs is Shut Up Little Man, the snippet, and their friends are like, what was that in between Stairway to Heaven and the Pixies? And it's like, that's their neighbors. And then so suddenly, this thing gets out into the world. Then that friend gives it to another friend. And suddenly, via this kind of analog viral thing, it starts to get out into San Francisco. Amazing.
There's one thing you talk about in the film, which is interesting, is the this kind of phenomenon of the sort of audio verite phenomenon in the early days, which is, it's interesting to see, as you said, this was in the kind of, it was kind of, had a primitive kind of sensibility because this wasn't anything, you couldn't go find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
You had no access to it then. You had to, somebody had to give it to you. You had to find it in some odd way.
That's right.
And there's a clip I wanted to play, which is from one of these, which is so... weird and funny too. This is tape of Orson Welles.
This is a classic, a radio classic.
Yeah.
I mean, radio. He was recording this. It was an advert for Findus frozen peas. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. He might have been drunk. I'm not sure, but he's mad.
He's mad. He doesn't like these guys that are recording these like radio, like very prim and proper BBC type voices. These English guys who are telling Orson Welles how to like do his lines. I mean, how dare they?
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire. Every July, peas grow there.
Could you emphasize a bit in July?
Why? That doesn't make any sense. That's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in and in July. Impossible. Meaningless.
I think all they were thinking about was that they didn't want to...
He isn't thinking. Too much directing around here. We know a little place in the American Far West where Charlie Briggs chops up the finest prairie-fed beef and tastes... This is a lot of... You know that.
Even Orson swears, folks.
So what was what's the appeal of that? It was a real moment, right?
Yeah, it was a real moment. When have you ever heard Orson say that word before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, as I was saying before YouTube, where, you know, Christian Bale, we all know that he did this insane rant, which is also in my film, because where you could Google anything, or where TMZ and these sort of places like expose, you know, celebrities at their worst or whatever. Before that, you know, how would you see this stuff? Well, people, these tapes would go around that were somehow secretly recorded in recording studios, and just leaked out into the world somehow. And there was this underground tape trading network. And people, you know, there'd be these zines, you know, photocopied zines. And you'd find out about it through this or via word of mouth. And this stuff would spread and people would post it.
Yeah.
So this is back in that day where you'd find out about this. You'd write to some guy and say, can you send me put your $6.99 in the post.
Here's a money order.
Yeah, get back Orson Welles ranting or a radio DJ, you know, going off his nana or whatever. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because... and this is where the film starts to kind of turn.
Yeah.
The film is because if you kind of understand the impulse behind it, it's complicated because it's funny, sure, but in some ways it's also kind of nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, Orson didn't know he was going to have that. I don't think Orson would care because he's Orson Welles. But I mean, you know, I mean, but there are a lot of cases where, I mean, just did Christian Bale had a delete button and he could have pushed the delete button and not had his rant out into the world. And I mean, he would have pushed it, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it's nasty. You know, it's usually stuff where people are captured at a bad moment and usually contextless as well. There's no we don't know what sort of day Christian had on the set of Batman or whatever, Terminator, whatever it was. You know, he could have had the worst day ever. I don't know. What did this guy do to him, this lighting guy? I don't know. But he goes off his trolley. You know, he goes bananas. But it's kind of cruel because we don't know anything about why he did it. We just laugh at him doing it.
Well, and the other thing is we all have those moments.
Totally.
And no one's around recording. We are as crazy at times. Think about it. When you lose your keys or when your dog does something.
Absolutely. Look, there's another one. There's another piece of Audio Verite in this, which Audio Verite is real life recordings.
Yeah.
So there's one of my favorites, which we've used a little slice of in the film, and I wish we could have used more. It was called Daddy's Curses. And it's my all-time favorite. And it's a thing recorded by a 14-year-old son. Of his dad called Bruce. And Bruce is fixing the family piano.
Right.
And he's not having a very good time of it. And he calls this piano every curse word under the sun. He calls himself every curse word under the sun. He's just... This goes for 14 minutes. And you picture this little kid with one of those old 80s little tape recorder things with the microphone standing there listening to his dad. My dad used to do it with pots and pans.
Right.
He would stuff pots and pans, and the next time he would open the drawer, they'd all fall out. And he'd, you know, it's, yes. But how often is someone standing around recording this stuff in our lives? Not very often. But actually, then again, maybe more so now. And that's what the film tries to do, is say that technology now is much more insidious. You know, like people, someone told me the other day about the latest kind of YouTube thing. A woman's texting on a thing. This is from a security camera in a mall. She's texting away and she falls into this fountain. Yeah. I haven't seen it. And, you know, this is this poor woman, and now she's like humiliated in front of the universe. You know about it. You're nodding knowingly.
She's going to
I haven't
sue
seen
them
yet,
all,
but
apparently.
I'm going to go to YouTube and check it out. You know what I mean? Like much now we're, you know, and the cameras are everywhere now. People have mobiles that can record. So we're all possible victims of this stuff.
Well, how do you think that Shut Up, Little Man how would it have been different had it happened in the, you know, the era of the internet?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. My theory is that it would have been over in a week. Like all of these things, like the girl that falls over in the fountain that we just talked about. You know, I'll check it out and then it'll be over. Like, you know, 20 million hits in a week and then she's forgotten. But I think with Shut Up Little Man, it goes a bit deeper than that. I think that's why these obsessive fans, it has obsessive fans. And it's had a life that's been a bit, that's longer. I mean, this was 1987 and I'm making a movie about it now and, you know, people have made films about it, plays and so on. There were 14 hours or so of recordings. It's much deeper than a, you know, like Star Wars Kid, the famous meme of the kid pretending to be a Jedi. He's had psychological traumas now, and now he's suing the kids that did it. I mean, you know, these things happen very quickly now, and it's over. But Shut Up Man, 14 hours. It's a deeper thing. It's like a it's a very rich vein of stuff. I think you can study it more.
Yeah. It's deeper, and you have to have a kind of an attention span as you go through it.
Absolutely. I think some people, it's a love or hate thing.
Yeah.
You can listen to it and hate it and never want to hear it again. I didn't love it the first time I heard it. It was not that I loved it. It was like, I found it intriguing, but also repulsive in some way.
Yeah.
But fascinating. And the more you listen to it, the deeper you get into it. And the more you understand the characters of Peter and Raymond and you sort of start to hear the turns of phrases and understand the kind of drama between them and the power play that goes on. It is like a Beckett play.
it absolutely is. I wanted to ask you about one thing that is important in the film is this idea of whether or not these tapes, are they art? Is Mitch and Eddie, are they trying to make art? And is it legitimate art? And then the things that people spin from it, you know, the plays, the puppet shows, the drawings, is that art?
It's a great question, and it's like one of the most fascinating ideas for me in the film. But I think it's like art is whatever you want it to be. We all know this. After, Armut put the toilet seat on the wall and called it art, it's the idea of the frame. If you put a frame around something and call it art, it can be art. But it's up to the audience to decide in a way. I mean, is the act of recording, you know, your neighbors fighting art? Maybe. Eddie thinks so. Mitch thinks so. But Eddie also thinks that that he's an urban folklorist.
Yeah.
He's created a lore, a legend, a story, a narrative around this whole thing. He has a website. He talks about these little things, about the skull on the window. These guys had a skull on their window. You know, Ray used to sit in front of the TV with this ginormous 6-foot stuffed bunny watching TV, hugging it while drinking vodka. So there's a kind of mythology of Shut Up Little Man that he's created. Now, I think that can be called art in a way. I think that it's any kind of storytelling is art. So. And then, of course, you have Devo sampling Shut Up Little Man and making this great track. You've got Greg Gibbs doing a stage play. People do paintings. You know, so, yeah, that's legitimate art.
Yeah.
So, but it's up to you to decide whether or not the actual, is it exploitative? Are the recordings exploitative? And that's the question the film asks of you, the audience.
Well, what's interesting about it is throughout the film, that question is how much of this is just plain old exploitation of these sad, broken down men. And what complicates things is that Eddie and Mitch aren't just passive in that relationship. And there's this sort of moment where they start to make these prank calls.
Yeah.
And that's when they start to – that's when they kind of start manipulating it. And that's when you start – as a viewer, you're starting like, wait a minute. That can't be good or that can't be right. Here's another scene. This is Mitch, I think it is. Yeah, Mitch, who calls Ray next door. And, you know, it seems funny. But if you think about it, it's not the same as just the passive recordings. Here's another scene from Shut Up, Little Man.
Are you calling him? You mean hold the mic? Let me hold the mic.
Hey Ray, say this is Ardell again. I just I forgot to leave a message last time when I spoke with you.
This is you?
This is Ardell. I was asking for Tony before.
Yeah.
Is he still a queer?
Hey, listen, you son of a bitch. You're not ready to find that you thought Tony was queer.
Well, you know, that's okay with me. I don't mind if Tony's queer. I just wonder.
Hey, look, you forget it. Hey, look, I was a mean mother in my time, and I still am.
Well, I know you.
Don't ever suggest a thing like that again. Ever.
You must be queer too, then, Ray.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'll tell you what, you piece of shit. How would you like me down the street? I'll show you what a queer is.
What should I do? Grab my ankles, Ray?
Right.
You're just a little man. I knew you were a little man.
Hey, don't call me a little man, you piece of shit. I tell you what, you're a piece of shit.
So, but you know what's interesting about that part of the film is I'm wondering if people who are watching it, is the audience is going to stop feeling as sympathetic, frankly, to Mitch and Eddie.
Yeah. I hope that the moral compass starts to sort of starts to spin a little there. And I hope it keeps spinning for the rest of the film. I was talking to them recently about that scene and how it was, because they were at the premiere the other night with us. And we talked about that scene and that they did feel uncomfortable about seeing it and on the big screen in front of people, you know, okay. And it feels kind of strange for them. And interestingly, when, you know, we got talking about the fact that they were like 20 years old when they made this recording. And, you know, I was thinking, well, I could have done a similar thing myself when I was 20. Mm. You know, when you're kind of you're that age. And the other thing you've got to remember is that they lived next door to these guys and for a long time, 18 months, and it was loud, and they didn't stop, you know, they didn't listen to them, their complaints. The cops would come around, they would tell these guys to shut up. They never shut up. And I just started to put me in their shoes and think, well, what would I do? What would you do? You know, like what, maybe you would want to sort of like enact your revenge in some way, even if it was that petty. But they were saying they felt very boyish, you know, very childish. It looked very childish. But, you know, you've got to think about them as 20-year-olds and that kind of thing. But yeah, it does. It's morally, again, it's this kind of very murky waters. And I still don't know. Is that nasty? It is nasty. And it's wrong, but it's kind of funny. And
yeah.
I don't know. It treads this weird precipice, this weird, like, moral kind of nebulous territory.
The filmmaker, the fellow who did Shrek, now...
Mike Mitchell,
forgive me. He has this moment where I think he asks kind of an essential question, and he kind of gets at it. Let me play this moment. Because he's become this...
He's a total obsessive fan.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Totally obsessed. He and his friends, just like Eddie and Mitch, they're doing the lines every day to one another. They are total obsessives.
What was the perfect storm for these guys to be doing it and someone recording it at the same time? It's really fascinating. And again, it's not fun to think of how illegal that might be and how invasive it is. I don't want to think about that. I don't want to know what happened before or after the argument. Just to hear them is just bliss. I just love it.
But it's also a little denial, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I want to know more about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel guilty listening to it. That's, you know, that's part of it. It's part of why I wanted to make the film, was to sort of like, you know, alleviate that guilt and find out why I feel guilty and kind of explore that, you know, like why. But why do I laugh, yet I'm guilty? And, you know, that's kind of interesting territory for a filmmaker,
yeah.
I think. But yeah, it seems weird that he would not kind of want to know more. I don't know.
Well, I wonder if, and I, actually this was something that kept coming up, because you kept seeing these different iterations of those tapes, you know. You mentioned a play.
Yeah.
And there was a movie, which I'll just say looked pretty crappy.
Yeah.
The film does, I mean, the play, the looking at it, doesn't look terribly, frankly, interesting.
Yeah.
And it's because, at least from my sense of it anyway, that it's not real. It's out of context. Maybe that's why people don't tell me anything more. I want to just know it for what it is. Because the more I learn, I lose my innocence, you know, or something like that.
I think, like I was saying at the start of the interview, the mystery, you don't want the mystery to be solved in a way.
Yeah.
That's why I wonder if my film is going to like sort of annoy some people, because they don't want to know. Like, well, you know, don't see the film. But yeah, there is a mystery, and maybe you don't want that solved because, as I said, when you first start listening to it, you ask yourself all these questions. I remember Mike Mitchell saying that when they first heard it, they were drawing it, trying to work out what these guys looked like. Mm. Daniel Klaus and Ivan Brunetti, two of these fantastic American comic artists, you know, Dan did Ghost World, and they're just brilliant. They, you know, this is ripe material for them. They listen to this audio recording, their imaginations, the juices start flowing. You know, if they saw the real Peter Haskett or Raymond Huffman, that kind of spoils it. Then it's just sort of portraiture.
Yeah.
You know, so, but their versions of what they imagined it looked like are amazing, incredible. So maybe that's why Mike Mitchell doesn't want to hear it, because in his imagination, they already know. It's like Lord of the Rings when I saw that movie. I love that book, but I saw the movie, and now when I read it, I'm like, oh no, then that guy is playing that guy, and yeah. That's not how I imagined it.
Yeah. There's this, the film takes another really intriguing turn when the question starts coming up. Eddie and Mitch are, they're sharing these tapes with anyone, and they're saying basically, look, whoever wants to use these for artistic purposes, go for it.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this huge phenomenon. And then all of a sudden they say, well, wait a minute. Maybe somebody should control it. And they copyright it.
That's right.
Let me play this excerpt. Because this is you actually asking Mitch, why is it? Whereas before you had just sort of let this stuff go.
That's right.
Why did you start now copywriting it?
Why did you feel like you needed to copyright the recordings?
We felt it compelled to, because it was, you know, all of a sudden people started using it and wanting it and wanting to use it and were asking us about legal aspects of it and felt like, well, we've got to do something about this to make it more ours.
And then it changes, you know, that changed everything.
Yeah.
Once they started, this question of control and ownership.
That's right.
Made it different.
Well, how do you own someone's sort of life,
yeah,
in a way? How do you own a kind of private recording, private conversation? It's a slippery thing, isn't it? How do you do that? Well, they made the recordings. Apparently in California, you can record a public conversation, and that is a legal thing, because these guys were so loud. If you stood on the landing of the apartment, that which is public property, and made the recording, then, you know, you own the recording. It's like, I remember Eddie telling me an analogy of that was the Rodney King video. Mm. The cops don't own the Rodney King video. Rodney King doesn't own the Rodney King video. The guy that was just happened to be passing with the video camera owns. That was his kind of comparison. But yeah, when this thing starts to get out in the world, they get a lawyer. The lawyers get involved, always with the lawyers.
Yeah.
The lawyers get involved, and I assume the lawyers told them and said, you've got to copyright this because it's, you know, now it's got market value. It's a commodity. You know, the big C stamp comes down, boom,
yeah,
copyright. Whereas before, they had this very free punk ethos. When you bought the tape originally, it said, you can use this for whatever purposes you like.
Yeah.
Go forth and spread the gospel of shut up, little man, and do whatever you want to do with it.
Right.
And yeah, later on, bang. Copyright.
Do you feel, having produced this film now, do you feel a part of the story now? Do you feel like you're a part of it?
Well,
now?
I guess, of course, I have to be. I'm now forever linked with Peter and Raymond and Eddie and Mitch and the rest of the rogues that are associated with this film, with this story. Absolutely. And I'm also kind of guilty of being, I'm complicit in the spread of the tapes, of course, of the recordings and the kind of, you know, the further kind of, I guess, exploitation, if that's how you feel about it, of Peter and Raymond. I guess in my defense, I would say that I'm trying to explore and understand and help the audience understand the nature of our relationships with this sort of entertainment. And I use that word with inverted commas. Is it entertainment? I'm posing a question to us all. Like, yeah, you know, this stuff we see on YouTube or listening to Peter and Raymond, is it art? Is it right? Should we be listening to this? Where does your moral compass kind of land?
Matthew Bate, the director of Shut Up, Little Man, an audio misadventure. Matthew Bate, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.